accession number 23339, reel 1.
Geoffrey Denny, reel 1. Can I ask you when you were born and where that was?
I was born in Houghton in Huntingdonshire on the 17th of February 1918. My father, who was a coach builder by trade, was sent up there to work as a woodworker on gun carriages and that sort of thing. Because of my family home was in Horsham in Sussex, and it just happened that I was up there when I was born.
You went back to Horsham?
Yes, yeah.
You spent your childhood in Horsham?
Yes, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? Tell me about the neighbourhood where you lived.
Well, it was a small country town in those days, and it hasn't developed as much as Crawley Newtown, just up the road, which is now expanded out of all recognition. But being a small country, Horsham being a small country town, people were very friendly, and it was very pleasant countryside around. I went to elementary school, as they were called in those days, and then got a scholarship to the local grammar school, which was Collier's School, and got my school certificate, and went and worked for a local family business in the motor trade until such time as I was called up.
How old were you when you left school?
16, yeah.
And tell me a little bit about your job before you joined the Navy.
Well, I was an office junior to start with, and then I did various clerical work in the motor trade. I was a cashier in the petrol station at one time, and helped with the preparation of the wages and that sort of thing, and the bills for the work which the mechanics had done out in the workshops.
What was the name of the firm?
Pardon?
What was the name of the firm?
Oh, the name of the firm was Jackson Brothers, it was only a partnership, and they were a little bit slow. They were very dependable and that sort of thing, but having been in the motor trade since the early 1900s, they hadn't really moved with the time. They'd been a solid local, well-respected firm who employed between 70 and 80 people in their Horsham workshop. Yeah.
Do you remember how much you got paid?
I started off at 10 shillings a week as an office junior, and I think by the time I was called up for the Navy, I was earning about 3 guineas or whatever they called them in those days, and that was it. I mean, that was average there. I mean, the mechanics in the first class mechanics in the garage there, they were only paid 1 and 6 pence an hour sort of business for a 45-hour week, and that meant that they took home something just over between just over £3, I suppose, and that was it. And everybody seemed to be quite content with their pay, and there was no trade union excitement to try and get a better rate of pay or anything. It would never have happened, I mean, that they got a salary increase, or a wage increase, as it was in those days.
Did you live at home during that time?
Yes, I was with my mother, father and sister in a 4 up and 4 down row of not cottages, but small houses.
And what sort of facilities did the house have? What was the kitchen like, the bathroom like?
Well, the kitchen was out at the back. There was no bathroom, and an outside lavatory next to the coal shed in the garden. And I think we put up with that. I mean, that was quite a recognised thing for what could you call us, working class people in those days. I mean, there was no idea of branching out to a bigger house or anything like that. I mean,
how did you spend your free time?
Well, after I left school, I joined the Scouts, and I went to a Scout meeting twice a week, and two or three of my friends who I'd been at school with and who had left at the same time as I had, they were used to go out for country walks. There was no hanging around the corner of the pubs or anything like that. I mean, it just wasn't done to go into a pub at my age then. And, we were quite happy, and I played football for a club, for an old boys club after the I left school. And at weekends I used to go down to the local cricket ground, where they had a cricket week once in the summer, and work the score box there, and that kept me amused all the time.
How did you come to join the Navy?
I actually, roughly around Easter in 1939, the government issued a small booklet, which was in fact a recruiting medium, inviting people of my age, and I was 20, 21 at that time, to join the auxiliary or the reserve forces. And I didn't fancy going into the army, being given a bayonet to stick into somebody. I didn't want to fly or go into the Air Force as ground staff, and so I thought I'd go into the Navy, where in the Scouts I'd been pretty proficient in semaphore signalling, and also got a working knowledge of Morse, and I thought that I could get a job in the Navy in the signals branch. But that didn't happen, because I was a ordinary seaman in the Sussex Division of the RNVR, and when I was called up as a seaman, that was it. I just had to go wherever I was drafted to.
Tell me about your time in the reserve before you got called up.
Well, we used to go, drive down to Hove from Horsham twice a week, and I won't say we played sailors there, but we were given a sailor suit. I did the swimming test in the local bars because I'd played water polo, county league water polo, and I suppose the other time I did the knots, splices and bends and hitches because I knew the knots from the scouts, and also a little bit of drill because it would need it to be smartened up more or less, and we were, well, pretty green recruits as far as the Navy was concerned when we were called up. Never been to sea, and no idea what the Navy was really like, but I thought it was probably preferable to the Army. And so I was quite content to see what happened to me.
Did you get paid for your work in the reserve?
Officially, we were paid half a crown a week for half a crown per drill night for going down. Well, virtually it was for travelling expenses to go down to Hove. We weren't paid anything for the job we were doing in the reserve, and as I recall, we were never paid air travelling expenses, and so I mean, I think the government got away with quite a bit in those days, which not well, I mean, when I was called up, I mean, there was sort of a general panic and scramble that you know, that was one of the things which wasn't essential.
How did you come to be called up? Tell me about that.
Well, I got my kit in a kit bag, and I had it already packed because I knew I wasn't going to be hanging around for very long. And then on the Tuesday after war was declared, I got the official brown envelope dropped on the doormat, instructing me to report down to the RNVR depot in Hove, and I walked along from where I lived and dropped in the key of the office safe to the firm which I was working, and up to Horsham Station and got a train down to Hove, I mean, and got down there for late morning, I suppose it was. When I got down to Hove Station, I walked down to the RNVR depot, which was on the seafront at Hove, and of course there were a lot of the other RNVRs. They'd been called up simultaneously, and we hung around there. We had a medical, I remember. The doctor who examined me was Dr. Reg Sutton, and he was the England water polo captain, you know, and I mean, I was pleased to have had a word with him. And Earl Howe, who was the commodore of the Sussex division, he, you know, just said, you know, you're going to go away to war, and I can't, you and neither you nor I know what will happen to you, sort of business, and all he could find to say was, what will be, as far as he was concerned, and with that ringing in our ears, we were put on a train to Portsmouth, where a lorry took us into the naval barracks there, and that's where we got really in touch with the proper Navy. And
tell me about your arrival at the barracks. What happened to you?
Well, all they did was took our details of the draft we were on and allocated us to one of the mess decks, which were Victorian, I suppose. I mean, but they were pretty overcrowded and, well, not quite a change from living at home, I can tell you that. And we started on our joining routine in the barracks, where not only did they give us another superficial medical examination, but also we were issued with a hammock, which we hadn't got before, and a gas mask, and that took up the greater part of the morning of the next day. And when I went back up to my mess for dinner on that day, to my surprise, although I didn't realise how swift it was, there was a draft kit telling me I was going to go to sea straight away. And so the next morning, they scrubbed the rest of the joining routine. They didn't check to see whether we'd got a proper lot of kit at all or not, and put us on a train up to London. They never told us where we were going, but I mean, the general impression was that it would probably be up to Scapa Flow, where the Home Fleet was based. And when we got up to London, there was a lorry took us across to Euston, as I remember it. We went into the restaurant there and were given a dinner, and immediately after dinner we were put on another train to go goodness knows where. At any rate, it went right the way up the length of England and into Scotland, and terminated in Perth. And they dumped us on the station in Perth at about 10 o'clock at night. You know, it was a Scottish evening in late summertime. And they told us that there'd be a train come along in the morning. So all we could do was to sit on their kit bags and hammocks and, you know, what a wild night away. And the next day they put another train came along and took us up to Thurso, which is where the railway finished. And then we got another meal up there, because we had no other meals. It was in some sort of a canteen place. Took us down to Scrabster Harbour, where the ferry came in, and to take us across to the Orkneys. And of course we put all our kit on board and that, and just as we went across the Pentland Firth, you're on the lookout for submarines as to whether we were likely to be torpedoed. But anyway, we got into Scapa Flow, went on to a depot ship, and then for the night, and then the next day the Home Fleet came in, and that was a very impressive sight, with the Nelson, the Rodney, and the big battleships all together with the destroyers. And a drifter came alongside the depot ship and took us, and we went, were taken out into the centre of Scapa Flow, and alongside Ark Wall. That was the ship we were going to, I mean, which was quite something, and we had to, before they got a gangway down, they put a jumping ladder over the side, and we had to climb up that, trying not to look a bit too green and ineffective, and so there we were on board Ark Royal.
What was your impression of the Ark Royal when you first
saw it? Well, enormous, I mean, because it was six decks high and, well, in volume, one of the biggest ships in the Navy. I mean, it was like a great big floating hangar, you see, with all the living accommodation, domestics, down near enough on the waterline, and then the aircraft were in two hangars, one on top of the other, up to the flight deck. And when we had settled in, we were told that our job was to be handling the aircraft. You know, we were sort of a funny hybrid sort of thing. We weren't fleet air arm, and we weren't sailors in the sense that we did no gunnery or anything like that. And so for the next couple of years, we were dealing with the aircraft when they came up from the hangars and pushed them down onto the after end of the flight deck, and were given jobs on the signal boom and the firefighting apparatus, and also on the chocks, and we had to lie down on the deck with the chocks fore and aft and the undercarriage, and then when they started it up, you know, we were pretty drafty. They were single engine Swordfish aircraft, but we soon got to know how to handle them, and it was quite something.
What sort of training did you receive for this job?
Well, we were only told that how to push the planes and not to swing up and down on the wings, and also keep out of the way of the air screw when that was buzzing around, because otherwise it would have chopped us in half, sort of business.
So what was your job when an aircraft was taking off?
Well, the flight deck officer waved away the chocks, and we had to hold the after chock behind the wheel to stop the aircraft from reversing at all, and then the flight deck officer waved a green flag to the pilot, observer and air gunner on board to rev up the engine and fly off, and all we had to do was to get out of the slipstream of the aircraft over to the side of the flight deck, ready for the next aircraft in the flight. They used to go off in about 8 or 9 a squadron at the time, you know, on reconnaissance and anti-submarine patrol. And when that was over, it was probably nearly time for the next lot to land on, you know. And they, when they came down, they had a hook on the undercarriage of the aircraft, and that caught up in the arrestor wires, which were across the deck. And as soon as that brought the aircraft to a halt, we had to go out and unhook it, press the hook up, and the aircraft taxied up to the forward end of the flight deck and ready to be struck down into the hangar. And that was a drill which we We weren't really involved in what the aircraft did. I mean, apart from you know, making sure that they, when they landed, the hooks were all properly unzipped, and then we just waited for the next flight to be piped, and the commander flying, he, after he'd sent off a reconnaissance of about half a dozen planes to fly out in a set courses all around the fleet to decide what the next air operation was to be, whether it was to send up fighters to protect the fleet, or depending on what we were doing, or they practiced their torpedo runs on the fleet as well.
Did the Swordfish go out every day?
Yeah, twice a day. They used to. We had an early morning call, and the first flight were all up on the flight deck and ready to go before dawn. And they used to go out, and from about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and come back after flying for about 3 or 4 hours to land on in time for dinner, and then after in the early afternoon there was another squadron went out on an afternoon reconnaissance, and they came back, well, just as it was getting dark, I suppose. Yeah.
You were an ordinary seaman.
Yeah.
At this time.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the structure of the, which, were you in a branch as such, or?
No, I was a seaman's branch.
And
I mean, and then there was the signalmen and the stokers and the cooks and the artificers and all those people, but.
Can you tell me about the structure of the branch that you were in, and how it interacted with the fleet air arm?
Well, the actual maintenance of the planes was in the hands of the fleet air arm tradesmen, the fitters and the armourers and those sort of people. And we were only, well, I was going to say unskilled helpers, but I mean, we had no official duties maintaining the planes or anything like that. I mean, all we had to do was to handle them when they were taking off and coming back on and landing back on. Yeah.
Who was your direct superior in rank?
There was a petty officer in charge of our R&VR flight deck party, as we were called, and he only allocated us the various jobs we did. We tended to do the same job each time, either on the chops or the signal boom or the firefighting apparatus or whatever it was.
Who would give you commands when the aircraft were landing and taking off?
Well, we knew what we'd got to do. I mean, they piped 812 squadron standby to receive aircraft, and we all went to our various places, either in the nets, which were the side of the flight deck, and we stayed there until the aircraft was on and the hooks had arrestor wires had stopped the car, the plane, and then we jumped out and unhooked it. That was the drill that we had to do then.
Jeffrey Denny Reel 2.